You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is December 19th, 2012, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? How's everyone?
Good. This is our 2012 year in review wrap-up episode, where we take a moment to look back at the year in skepticism and the SGU. Did you guys all have a good year?
It was all right.
Yeah, it was good.
Some ups, you know.
Yeah,
more
significant
ups and downs.
Ups and downs. Yep.
Jay, you just finished moving into your new house.
I did.
That's an up.
My body is killing me, my God.
That's a down.
Yeah. We had our half of our stuff already packed from a year and a half ago that we couldn't even open because we didn't have the space and we were saving money. Like, we're opening up our wedding presents for the first time right now.
Yeah.
It's like second Christmas.
Yeah, it is. It's pretty cool. Like, there are things that I own that I had completely forgotten about.
I just like throwing out tons of stuff. It's amazing how quickly you accumulate junk in life, you know?
Especially with kids.
Yeah.
Kids help.
You can't throw out kids. That's illegal, Evan.
One thing I learned, though, nothing like a divorce, though, to cut down on how much junk you have.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. Mental
really help
too, yeah.
Yeah,
I got squat now.
ups and downs.
That's right.
Well, Rebecca, you're going to tell us about this day in skepticism.
Yes. On this day, which is December 29th, in 1790, an obituary was posted for Thomas Fuller. Have any of you ever heard of Thomas Fuller before?
You mean Negro Tom?
Negro Tom, what? As he was known in his, in the obituary. Yeah, I had never heard of him before. He sounds really amazing. So he was a slave who was brought to America, when he was only 14, and he was born in Africa somewhere between Liberia and Benin. And late in his life, it became well known that he was this mathematical genius. Apparently he was really good at doing complex mathematics in his head. He apparently couldn't read or write in English, but had self-taught himself? No, that's not right.
It's redundant.
But
it's redundant and unnecessary.
He was self-taught. He was self-taught. And
he had taught himself a great number of arithmetical operations, riddles, and mathematical games and things like that. For instance, some guys came to visit him to test what he could do. And they asked him a few questions to determine whether or not he was, in fact, a mathematical genius. First, they asked him how many seconds there were in a year and a half, which he apparently took about 2 minutes to answer, 47,304,000. And then they asked how many seconds a man has lived who is 70 years, 17 days, and 12 hours old. And in a minute and a half, he came up with the figure 2,210,500,800. And one of the guys who was testing him said, no, that's wrong. The actual answer is much smaller. And Fuller replied, stop, master, you forgot the leap year. And when the leap year was added in, the sums matched.
Sweet.
So, he was a genius, and he was often used by abolitionists who were pointing out the fact that slaves were just as intellectually rigorous as white men. And yeah, so he was an amazing guy. And in his obituary, it concluded, had his opportunity been equal to those of thousands of his fellow men, even a Newton himself need have ashamed to acknowledge him a brother in science. Thomas Fuller.
Yeah, very interesting. I also read that it's probable that he learned his mathematical skills while in Africa. He didn't acquire them after being brought to Virginia.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't really have much opportunity to acquire them in Virginia.
So that means his brain operated in such a way with a strong disposition towards mathematical calculations.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, almost certainly he was a mathematical prodigy, and there, you know, there are those people around today.
You know, don't mistake him for necessarily being a sort of idiot savant type, because it doesn't appear that that's the way he was. He seemed to be just a normal guy, yeah, just with an incredible brain for mathematics.
Goes to show you don't need the environment. It's the brain that's really, you know, the key here.
Well, I think math is one of those things that is very hardwired, you know, your ability to, for math. But that's funny you bring up the idiot savant thing, because that a lot of the pro-slavery people at the time dismissed his evidence of, you know, intellectual equality among Africans by calling him and dismissing him as an idiot savant.
Right.
So you could just dismiss the evidence away. It's like, oh, he's not really intellectually, you know, equal to the white man. That's just, it's a trick. It's like a trained monkey. You know, he's just an idiot savant.
Yeah. No surprise that they were coming up with any excuse they could.
Yeah. Right. There was, but you know, the Africans were trading with Europeans, and the African merchants and traders were able to calculate sums in their head and do the trade. You know, they had mathematics. You know, it existed. So, it's not as if he wouldn't have had access to anything like that, you know, in Africa. Very interesting. Well, for our year in review episode, we look back over the best and worst and most interesting and some highlights from the previous year, from 2012. We're going to start with the most interesting science news items of 2012. We've been collecting votes from some of our listeners, but we also have some of our own. So what do you guys want to start? Who wants to go first with their pick for the best science news story of 2012?
My favorite is the rover landing.
Yes, that's what I chose too.
Yep, the Curiosity landing, that's in everyone's list in the top five. A lot of people voted for that. I agree. That was a huge news story. It was a technical
tour de force.
Tour de force, absolutely. I mean, NASA really deserves kudos for that. And it's doing good science.
It is the event itself. I mean, watching it unfold, you know, live or as live as it could be with the signal delay and so forth, you know, there was a real suspense, and it sort of did entice a lot of people, even people who don't really know or have much of an interest in science. They were glued to their televisions and to their computer monitors to kind of see exactly what was going to happen, what was going to reveal. Very, very riveting moment.
And the cost of failure was just had me on the edge of my seat, because I was just thinking, oh man, this thing is just going to make a Curiosity crater, like I said. I was very nervous, because imagine one little, you know, metric error and bam, it's hundreds of millions of dollars shot. People's careers, literally their careers, just cut short, because I'm sure they had planned on spending so much time gathering and analyzing all this information that's streaming to us now. It was amazing.
I think one of the big wins here was the proof that people will still be interested in this stuff even when humans aren't on board. You know, with recent cutbacks, and there's been a huge question on will we ever bother putting people, you know, into space, sending them to the moon again, things like that. And a lot of the arguments are, well, we do that to inspire humans. But I found the Mars rover landing to be really inspiring, and I think a lot of other people did too.
Oh yeah, that was one of the elements to it that it actually sparked my interest again. You know, the space shuttle going away was very depressing, and I know that the space station's up there, but I hate to admit it's gotten a little mundane. You know, as ridiculous as that sounds, and the one other comment I wanted to make was the fact that the landing sequence was so complicated. And every step had to work perfectly. You know, the way that they slowed it down, the platform, the arm lowering it down, everything. All of those things somebody dreamed up, and we pulled it off, and we had never done it before. It was the first time we had done anything like that.
But speaking of that, Jay, something else that's in the top of a lot of people's lists was the SpaceX launch, the Dragon capsule. This may mark the real beginning of commercial spaceflight.
True that.
Yeah, I mean, it is the beginning of commercial space flight, and the fact is it's feasible for companies now to not only afford to do it, but they can, from a technological standpoint, they can do it. But now what we have is the beginning of probably a huge growth. Imagine if there were 20 or 30 companies launching and doing different things in outer space.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to have a lot of ships entering low Earth orbit, and it's going to be a daily occurrence. It's going to be something that we're going to not even care about anymore, like planes taking off.
Yeah, eventually. I mean, I do think that we could be entering into a new era of real cooperation between governments and private industry, a new phase of that. Obviously, we've always had that to some extent. You know, NASA would contract with companies to make rocket boosters or, you know, components of their ships. But now we have a company really taking a much bigger role, designing, building their own ship. And NASA, big government agency, can farm out or, you know, contract out actually delivering things into space, delivering goods to the space station now, perhaps eventually delivering people, you know, back and forth from this space station. So it's shifting that balance a little bit from government to more cooperative between government and private industry. And I think that's a good thing because you can kind of get the best of both worlds then. There are certain things that governments do better because of their size, and there are other things that companies can do better because they are going to be more competitive and more efficient.
Yeah, less bureaucracy, red tape, and
yeah,
more adaptable. But I think you guys missed, you've all missed the boat.
I haven't given mine yet, but go ahead. I know what you're going to say about it.
Okay. All right. Yeah, Curiosity landing and SpaceX, yeah, they're on my top five. But number one, I think it's a no-brainer, sorry. But it's got to be Higgs.
Yeah, the Higgs.
I'm glad the physics world has been apparently listening to me because their award recently for the 2012 breakthrough of the year went to the discovery of Higgs and went to specifically the CERN, ATLAS, and CMS teams that were in charge of the whole thing. Just an amazing. If you just counted the sheer number of words that went into this news item, I mean, throughout the year we kept getting hit with it all throughout the year. It wasn't just like, oh, you know, in July or September we talked about it. It was like an all year event.
It was,
and it's still happening.
This is the year that we knew it was something big was going to happen. But you're right, Rebecca. To cap it all off, just recently they announced that CERN is now 99.999999% sure that what they found was a Higgs-like boson that the standard theory predicts. And that means that they're approaching 7 sigma certainty, which is well above the 5 sigma, which is the gold standard. So it's pretty much a done deal. I mean, this is pretty much the Higgs. And it's funny, they still won't really say it. And they're predicting they won't until maybe 2015 really officially say, yes, it's the Higgs boson.
And also I saw a recent news item that said they might have found two different particles because there's one with a mass of.
Really?
Yeah, here we go. There seems to be a Higgs boson with a mass of 123.5 GeV, giga electron volts, and another Higgs boson at 126.6 GeV, a statistically significant difference of nearly 3 GeV.
Mm-hmm. Whoa, I gotta look that one up.
And so they're trying to figure out if it was a mistake in the data analysis or if there are in fact two different particles. The cool thing about this is that, you know, this is going to be shaping science for years to come. They're going to continue getting stuff out of this. They're going to continue making new discoveries and refining this discovery. So, yeah, I agree with Bob. It's either this or dinosaur farts. One or the other is the greatest.
I knew that was going to happen.
They're very close. So what do you think, these researchers will win the Nobel Prize in about 30 or 40 years, assuming they're still alive?
Probably won't take that long. 10, 15 years, maybe.
Yeah.
Wait till the dust settles. So you guys are all between the Higgs and the Curiosity. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yep.
And dinosaur farts.
And dinosaur farts.
What do you got, Steve?
All right. So before I give you mine, I'll give you, so our listeners voted for those. Higgs, Curiosity is top of everybody's list. SpaceX, you know, honorable mention. Some mentioned the Venus transit. Very cool. I agree. Oh, that was a lot of fun.
That was awesome.
Venus transiting the sun. It was amazing. I did what you were supposed, one of the mechanisms for viewing it. It was very simple. Just binoculars and a white piece of paper, a white board. And you could see it. You could see the spot of Venus moving across the surface of the sun. It was cool.
Yeah, and I think I mentioned when we talked about this before, but it was really awesome to go. I went to the local science museum because I heard that they were setting up telescopes and they had glasses and stuff. And I found, like, they had already given away all of the glasses they could and were asking people to recycle them. And the place was just flooded with kids and families who were excited to see it. And it was really awesome seeing kids particularly, but also whole families turning out to get excited about this.
Yeah, it was definitely something. and yeah, a science, astronomy, excitement kind of event. Very cool.
Yeah.
So I chose something that I knew wouldn't just be redundant to everybody else's choice. One of the biggest, I think, stealth science news items, and it was really multiple studies, multiple events, not one thing, this year, was the development of the brain-machine interface. And I really think we're, that in 2012, it's all incremental advances, you know, but I do think was maybe we're sort of turning a corner in 2012. And this was capped off by a very recent news item. Researchers have developed, taken another advance in implanting electrodes. What they did was they implanted two strips of 96 electrodes each on the motor cortex of a woman who's a tetraplegic, who's paralyzed below the neck, so can't move her arms and legs, and attached it to a sophisticated robot arm that has 7 degrees of freedom. So meaning that there's 7 different ways you can manipulate it. You can close and open the grip. It could bend in 3 dimensions and be positioned in 3 different dimensions. That's 7 different ways it could be moved.
She was feeding herself chocolate. It was awesome.
Absolutely. It took, on the second day, she was able to move the arm. And then she rapidly gained greater and greater control and coordination with the arm. It was a 13-week study. And, you know, by the end of the study, she was using it with, they said, the researchers said, with, you know, more facility than any other previous study. And not quite, but like getting to the level of a normal arm, you know, of an arm that.
Oh, come on.
And then they took it away from her.
Well, it was in, she's in the lab.
It's science,
you know,
man. That's science.
Yeah, I mean, this is it. I mean, we're developing a brain-machine interface where, you know, we can be able to hook up paralyzed people to robot arms or virtual arms or whatever, anything, you know, controlling computers, controlling robotics. It works. The technology works. That you could learn to, you know, just think and move that arm. And all of the basic groundwork is laid for taking it to the next step of the brain-machine brain interface, where you, the device also provides sensory feedback. So they've done this in a monkey where they, some of this research is in monkeys, some is in humans. One of the monkey studies, they had electrodes on the somatosensory cortex and they had the monkey controlling a virtual arm. And the monkey was, learned how to distinguish different virtual objects by different sensory feedback, meaning that the virtual objects had a different texture. They felt different to the monkey. And that was the only way to sort of tell the difference. There's other research that shows that with brain plasticity and by manipulating this sensory feedback, we could make people feel as if they're occupying a virtual or artificial limb or entire body. One simple experiment is if you have someone sit next to a table where their real arm is underneath the table, and maybe
covered
with a blanket or something so they can't see it. And then you have an artificial arm coming off their shoulder and laying on top of the table. So they're seeing an artificial arm, you know, on top of where their real arm is. And then you scratch the artificial arm so they could see that happening while somebody under the table scratches their real arm in the same place. So the brain sees and feels the fake arm being touched. And then suddenly, for many people, that is enough to make them feel as if that is their arm, that the fake arm is their arm. So.
That's not really a recent advance.
No, that bit is not recent.
Part of the,
but this is, I'm just saying, the groundwork has been laid over the last decade to show that it's theoretically possible with, you know, by having motor and sensory, electrodes on the brain, to have someone not only control a robotic arm, but feel the arm, feel as if they own it and control it, and that they occupy it, and that it could actually even feel natural for them. That, now we don't know what the limits of that are, especially in an adult. We don't know what the limits of plasticity and training and everything will be, but it seems like it could be, pretty close to real, you know, like real bionic limb kind of thing, you know, where it feels like it's your own arm.
That's what incredible promise. But Steve, for me though, I keep thinking that the big leap though, that's going to be required. I mean, they actually still had to scratch his real arm. I mean, that was, and that's, to me, that's kind of like the weak link in that because the guy still has an arm that can be scratched. If they could have replicated the feeling of a scratch in somebody who didn't have the arm.
Well, Bob, but that was the monkey experiment I told you about where they the monkey was able to tell the quote unquote texture of virtual objects by sensory feedback directly to the somatosensory cortex. So that, I mean, you have to, these pieces have not been put together yet, but they're all there.
And so, this research has been used to help people who have lost limbs cope with ghost limb pain. So yeah, it's all there.
Yeah. There's a number of different labs. There's Duke, Brown, and Pittsburgh are the three in the U.S. that I've been seeing studies coming out of. So that's good that there's different centers working on it. And, every year, every 6 months or so, I see another study where they are doing a little bit better, you know, more electrodes, greater control, more functionality. Some other piece of the puzzle gets put into place. And I just don't see any theoretical barriers anymore to having a robot arm that you feel like you own and control, you know, with the whole sensation.
So how long do you think it'll be, Steve, until we have something that's really close?
Well, 5 years.
We have something now that could actually be useful for people who are paralyzed. Imagine having a robotic arm attached to your wheelchair with electrodes, you know, going onto your motor cortex, and you're otherwise completely paralyzed, you know, below the neck. But now you can manipulate your environment. You can feed yourself and whatever, you know, you can do stuff, which is better than not being able to do anything.
Yeah.
So, but what is the person going through in order to manipulate it? I mean, what are they actually, do they have to like manipulate their alpha waves or think something specific? I mean, will it get to the point, or is there any hint that it could soon get to the point where they act, where it's just completely unconscious? Well, I guess shouldn't be a problem, but I'm just wondering what will it be like in terms of, you know, a real arm and this fake arm?
You want it to be seamless, Bob, right?
No, this is with pure thought, and that's been shown too. You do not have to physically move something. That study's been done too, Bob. You don't have to physically move something. You can disconnect the physical movement from the thoughts that are necessary to control the robotic arm.
Yeah, I realize that, but my point is what's the experience like?
Yeah, I don't know. I'd love to talk to these people and find out what they say. But because it's on the motor strip, right? That's what it's reading. It's reading their intent to move something, to move that arm. And it's just the computer is interpreting that and translating that into the movement. And so then they, with the feedback of seeing how the robot arm moves, they learn to control it. And their brain begins to map to it. That's the key, is that the plasticity kicks in to the point where the brain starts to map to the movement. And then, you know, eventually, they just have to think of the movement they want to do, just like you do, you know, with your own arm. And once you add the sensory feedback, I think it's really going to take it to another level.
Yeah. Well, now extrapolate that a little bit. Imagine if the brain is plastic enough, imagine if you could manipulate two fake arms, but imagine if there's like 50 fingers on each arm, on each hand. I mean,
well,
imagine if you can do that type of thing and go beyond manipulate things beyond what a normal, you know, a regular person would be able to do.
How could you sense 50 fingers, though?
I mean, well, how do you sense 10? I mean, you could sense 10. I mean, you can manipulate.
Because we're born that way.
So that's a really good question, Evan. And I had that question, too. Could you have a 6 arms, you know, and could you?
Why not?
Doc Octopus, you know?
But that was the question, Bob, is the brain plasticity sufficient that it could map to limbs that don't normally exist, to supernumerary limbs? And the answer to that is, yes, it can.
Ooh,
it can.
Oh,
it can map to things you never had. So
sure.
There's no theoretical
reason.
I'm
gonna get a penis.
Yeah, there's, you always wanted one, didn't you, Rebecca?
Rebecca. 10 penis.
there's no theoretical limit why your brain couldn't eventually, through plasticity, learn to map, to own, to control limbs that you were never born with. Isn't that cool?
So it's just what you get yourself used to at that point.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right. And imagine if you do this to kids, you know, where they have even greater plasticity. I think the limits are even less in terms of what.
Steve, with that thinking, you could have a tentacle.
Yeah, you could have tentacles. Sure.
To go with
tentacle
your penis.
Penis.
That's like the
Japanese
penis.
Are gonna love me.
That's the the Centaurans on Babylon 5. Prehensile penises.
Yeah. Oh, all right. God, all right. Come on. Let's keep going. We got a lot of
ground. All right. I know. You're right. That was a good one. All right. So let's move away from science news items. Just other best of. We asked our listeners to tell us what they thought was the best episode of the year. And let me just tell you the two that got the most votes, and then we could tell our personal choices. Far and away, I think our most popular episode this year was the Prometheus review.
The Prometheus movie review.
Yeah, where we tore apart the awful science, not to mention the awful writing, in the movie Prometheus.
Hey, I finally watched that. I watched it on the airplane.
And?
So what'd you think?
And?
I thought it was great.
Looking into the future.
No, you know what I genuinely did like, though, was the abortion scene. I thought that was awesome. Like, she ripped that thing out of her. That was great. The rest of it
was terrible. Levels, that was very cool, yeah.
And the funniest part by far was the woman running away from the thing that was falling down, and she couldn't run sideways for some reason. She had to run straight back.
Did it occur to anybody on the crew, like, wait, I saw this in Bugs Bunny 20, 30 years ago?
Well, it would have been, a couple hundred years ago at that point, so.
Well, the reason why
still
people,
be around, my friend.
I think the reason why it's people true. Enjoyed that segment a lot, there was like, a lot of things crisscrossed, a lot of awesome variables aligned. It was the perfect storm.
It was
a highly anticipated movie. It was horrible science. So the disappointment factor alone fueled our anger. And, you know, we all got riled up about this a lot. Like, I'm still pissed off about it.
It was fun. It's fun to take down movies like that. And it was the disconnect between the possibility, the hope, and the reality was just terrible.
Yeah. We got to do it again. It's rare to have such a perfect storm for a review like that. But we got to definitely keep an eye out for that in the future and do another segment.
We had a lot of fun with it, too. And we talked about we should do more science movie reviews like that. So we certainly have an eye out for new movies coming out that sort of fit that profile. But if our listeners have any suggestions for even existing movies that they would like to hear us take down,
yeah,
send us your suggestions. Yeah. We had a fun with it. We'd love to do it.
We can do it.
The second, I think, most popular episode was the private recording at Dragon Con, where we had Phil, Brian Brushwood,
and George,
and even Derek made a brief cameo as well. So it was, I think, the combination of those guests was really fun, and we all had it was live. We were all in the same room. Yeah, we all have a good time. I think people felt the energy of that show.
Until I went insane.
Yeah.
That show went on forever. It was so late.
No, it was good. Those shows have an energy about them that none of our other shows that we've done, right?
Yeah.
Have. It's unique. It's just different.
And Jay, talk about no filter, especially like the first 10 minutes, you were going crazy, Jay. You were really giving everyone their money's worth. It was very funny to sit right next to you and hear you going off totally. Like,
well,
like
me and Brian were going nuts on each other. Yeah. Yeah, remember like the whole team dumb, team smart crap?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun. I love doing those private shows. They're definitely some of the best times I think we have too. You know, a lot of this stuff, it's like hurry, 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 get there. It's a lot of work for us. And the only real fun times for us are when we are doing the show, even if we're on a bigger stage. But the small recordings are great because, you know, the people are sitting 3 feet from us. Like, they're doing it with us.
Yeah, they're not an audience. They're really just, it's more intimate, and they add to the energy of those shows. That's
and the immediate feedback. We definitely feed off of that.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, one of our listeners said that their vote for the best episode was any live show. They just liked the live shows.
Awesome.
But, you know, sometimes, though, some people give us negative feedback. They don't like the added humor and silliness of the live shows. They like more content, more like the hard science content. So it's not everyone's cup of tea, but it's a few times
a year. Don't worry.
We're
not going to go to 100% live shows.
It's a few times a year. It's a good change of pace.
That skeptical 12-step program was really clever, Steve.
Thank you.
You and George worked that out, I think.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Really good. Really good job there.
Yeah. That was fun.
I think my favorite show along these same lines, I think my favorite one to do was the live one at Nexus, the behind the scenes one with Randy and Seth Shostak.
That was cool.
Where we were all like crammed into that hotel room with 30 of our best friends.
All gathered round on the floor.
Rebecca, that's on my list. And for two main reasons. One was that sitting relaxed. I was like sitting right next to Randy, just like hanging out on a couch, talking with everybody. And the other big thing for me was just to hear Seth Shostak say at some point, I agree with Bob. That just made my entire day.
You know what I noticed? Like the more intelligent the guest, the more they don't like me.
What? That's an illusion.
I think you
Jay.
Might be reading into that a little
I
too
know.
Much.
They don't like you anyways.
My favorite show, sadly, Rebecca wasn't there.
Oh.
Yeah.
But the Richard Wiseman live recording was my favorite of this entire, maybe of all time. That's show.
Certainly been the most divisive from listener feedback. That, like, people either loved that show or hated it. And yeah. I think it depends on whether they are okay with the silliness.
Yeah.
Because it was silly. Brought the silliness.
It got silly. Oh gosh. Well,
Richard is
he's impossible to stop. He's like a juggernaut.
Yeah, he is like just incredibly intelligent, but then he can turn on the insanity, that level of funny. And he does it in absolutely awesome, dry British delivery.
Well, he won the line of the year, I think.
Well,
I
have recordings if you guys would like to hear some of his better lines.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sure.
Yeah.
I was nearly sued by a gorilla.
All right, well, the first news item we're going to talk about is...
I've got a dead dog in my garden. I've got a dead dog in my garden. I moved into this house...
That was funny. It was the timing of it was perfect too.
The timing was brilliant.
And just that British deadpan. So, I've got a dead dog in my garden.
No, like when you come up with this stuff. But the thing is, you know, he throws out these one-liners, but then he's got these epic stories to back them up.
Well, yeah.
About the gorilla. Like he actually almost got sued by the people who handled the Coco the gorilla.
Right. And he was excited because he wanted to be able to say that he was sued by a gorilla.
Yeah, then he said,
"I absolutely
said,
see that.
If I lose, of course I'm going to have to pay him with bananas, right?
Bananas, yeah.
You know that when he got that very first notification that he was being sued, you know the first thing he thought, that this is fantastic. I could now say in all seriousness that I almost got sued by a gorilla. You know he was just totally thinking that.
Yeah.
What a line.
He couldn't wait, yeah.
Do you guys have any other favorite shows?
The SciCon live show was a lot of fun, really for one reason. We talked so much about zombies, it was awesome.
Oh, yeah.
Remember we showed everyone, a lot of people, as they would look as a zombie, and then we talked about who we'd want to partner with and during the zombie apocalypse. That was just a high point for
yeah,
me.
Yeah, what weapon great. You'd want and all that.
Yeah.
Apparently, poor Jeannie Scott got cornered all weekend from people telling her.
Thanks to you.
Yeah. So, sorry about that, Jeannie. She's still my pick, though. She's
she was your pick for your partner in a zombie apocalypse. And
yeah, Jeannie Mother Scott, man. Because she's a cold-blooded killer when it comes down
so
to it.
That's what her middle name is. Yeah. Okay, now I know.
And what about then best guest or interview? You already talked about Richard Wiseman, and he did get a lot of votes.
Billy West also got a lot of...
Oh, yeah.
Billy
that
West.
Was number yeah. one. That was number one for me. I have a big regret on that for that. Because of the scene, we sat down and we were waiting for our turn and there was typically one person interviewing him, at a time and they were very tight mm-hmm. on time you could just tell he doesn't suffer fools lightly. I mean, you just can't just wing an interview with him. You've got to be thoughtful and ask good questions and be interesting. And then we were going to go on and Steve and Jay and Evan, We're all going to interview him, and I bowed out because I figured, all right, I don't want to inundate this guy and upset him with all these guys throwing questions at him. So I sat on the sidelines and watched, it was the best interview, one of the best interviews of the year. I was like a giddy little girl. It was just so silly. I was just giggling. It was just so awesome. He's such a fantastic interview, with his voices and his history. And I just loved it. One of my favorite interviews.
My sense was that he enjoyed doing that interview because it wasn't the typical canned expected interview. He gets asked the same questions over and over and over and over again.
Yeah, he liked us.
We didn't even
he loved us.
He took to us.
You don't have to ask a guy like him to do voices. I mean, he mixes them in. I felt really comfortable talking to him, which was great. Like he wanted to have a good time, and that's all I need. If somebody wants to enjoy themselves, I can get into it. But the thing that I loved the most about talking to him was I wanted to pick apart his psychology a little bit. You know, the one thing I brought up, which I was really dying to ask him, was what do you do to entertain yourself, like in the car or whatever? And that whole mm-hmm. that moment came out where he revealed that he does entertain himself and do voices in the car. I think a lot of people, Like, I know George does that. I do that. That's just like a way for someone to blow off steam. But, you know, when you have some talent behind it, it like, imagine being a fly on the wall in his car.
Oh, yeah.
Cars don't have walls.
Well, a couple of people got chosen because they were outside the box. So Jan Bellamy, who is a lawyer that we interviewed earlier in the year, she got a few votes because we don't talk about legal issues with actual, you know, legal experts that often. So they appreciated that it was something different.
Yeah, along that line, I thought maybe beyond Billy West, the interview we did with the fellow who knows a lot about fracking, Gordon Malpin.
Right.
That was interesting.
That was a very informative
interview
that we conducted, and he dispelled some myths and, you know, kind of put to rest some things that we might have otherwise had to, you know, be concerned about. And very, very informative and also a little bit outside the box in a certain sense. I enjoyed it very much.
Yeah, I agree. I like those interviews where we go outside of the usual skeptical, you know, repertoire that we have and pick on somebody who just has a narrow area of expertise just to talk to us about what they know. Yeah, you know, I love those kind of interviews. Yeah, Joshy Berger got a lot of votes.
Right. He's always he's
hilarious. Favorite. Yep, a lot of energy. He was just on the show a couple of weeks ago. We did the Jewy or Fiction with Jay Evan and I.
That was a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun. It's funny. We got a few emails about that, and they start by saying, "I want to talk to you about the Joshy Berger bit with, you know, about Orthodox Jews," and you don't know where, like, there was no indication for, like, the first paragraph where the emailer was going.
Right. I'm just positive.
I'm just waiting for it to drop. Are they going to slam us for, I don't know, criticizing a culture or people or whatever? And then they went into the fact that they loved it, and then they were like Orthodox Jews or ex-Orthodox Jews or still in, but skeptical and doubting. You know, the supernatural beliefs in their heritage, and they just loved going at it. And they all agreed that Joshy knows his stuff when it comes to that.
Of course, definitely.
Does.
You know, Joshy is very intelligent. I mean, I'm friends with Joshy, and you know, he has a huge bravado, and that's him, and that's exactly who he is, and he doesn't hide an inch of himself. But you know, he used to be a lawyer, guys. Joshy's educated. He is much, much more intelligent than he wears on the outside. And you can see it when he does bits like that. You know, he puts himself together very well, and he puts his information together very well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Speaks three languages. Yep.
Another interview that got some votes is Bruce Hood. So this is I agree. I always love interviewing Bruce. It's right in our sweet spot. He's a psychologist whose research interest and his books are about the kind of things that skeptics need to know about, you know, the way our psychology works and how that influences us and biases us. That's exactly the kind of content. I think, you know, I put him up there like with Richard Wiseman and other psychologists who are, that's part of the core curriculum of skepticism, in my opinion. So I always love doing those interviews. All right, what do you guys think? You know, funniest moment, we already mentioned I Have a Dead Dog in My Garden, which was definitely got a lot of votes. You guys have any other funniest moments from the show?
Jay's Thanksgiving science fiction.
His Savant episode.
Yeah, that was awesome.
So funny.
I took an audio clip if you want to hear it, guys.
Do you know which president made it an official national holiday?
Abraham Lincoln.
Oh, Abraham Lincoln, yep.
Holy shit.
Oh my God, I know a lot about Thanksgiving!
And wow, Jay, wow, which so president...
How did I know
Skeptic's
that?
Skeptic's Guide to Thanksgiving.
When, when and which president solidified the date as the fourth Thursday in November? I'll be impressed if you
come on, Jay.
One.
You come can on, do Jay. This.
Was it FDR?
Yes!
Oh my God! Oh my God! I'm serious.
It was FDR.
Wait.
Jay is the best at fifth grade social studies.
Every day is Thanksgiving.
Right.
Well, Steve, is this what it feels like to be you?
That was funny.
That was one of my favorite lines you just said there too.
Jay comes into his own.
It felt so good. I think about all the time. Like I would love to be more intelligent. Of course, I'm sure most people. Think about that. I felt so powerful that night.
You were unstoppable.
But then you regressed to the mean and the moment was gone.
He's been 10% dumber every day since.
It's equal.
I have another favorite moment, favorite little bit that we did. This one revolves around Bob.
Ooh.
If you look up in the sky, you're not going to see any of these because they're just too dim. But if you could see them, there's lots. There's 70.
If you looked up at the sky, the most common star you won't see.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
That's a red dwarf.
That was funny.
That was awesome.
Yes, it was.
Well, Jay, I have a similar Thanks, moment Jay. Sticks out for me. It was at another live show. When you said, in all earnestness, I'm not trying to be pedantic.
Yeah. Oh, yes, the whole pedantic.
Became one of our favorite memes of the year.
The funniest thing of the pedantic thing is when I used it like a week later and then got an email from somebody saying, I think Rebecca means pedantic. Now I look like the dumb one.
Yeah, it's catchy.
That was the plan, Rebecca. So, yeah, somebody was being pedantic about the word pedantic, but just missed the inside joke, which we do. We throw out a lot of inside jokes.
How could you miss that inside joke? I don't, yeah. It happens.
But people have used that to me since, you know, pedantic. Yeah. It's definitely
I've
became a meme.
I've also heard that a lot.
Yeah.
I mispronounce a lot of things if you haven't noticed.
Uh-huh. You do. That should be the next supercut is Jay mispronounce all the things Jay mispronounces, including the ones that don't make it to air. That would be hilarious.
Jay, one of our listeners sent in a mashup. These are all quotes from Evan. This is Jason Ferber, who I believe did the mashup of you from last year.
Yeah. And I think he did one of you, Steve, as well, didn't he?
Did he? Yeah, I think you're right.
So it's my turn to be mashed. I love it.
Okay, get ready, Ev.
Claire Danes. A blizzard. It would not be difficult, mein Führer. If you break a leg, break your other leg.
Bully.
Flügen is German for fly.
You want, like, their website to kind of have an accident?
You know who else had a little tattoo? They were getting it on. So a coordinated disinformation campaign is underway.
Looks like the scientists said, look at the bones! What are you thinking about?
And therefore dinosaurs. G-spot.
Gimli.
A Bigfoot in Texas. There's a new miniature horse species they found called My Little Ponyus. Alien ship. A lot of holes in that report. Oh. Big Sugar. I like that.
Cool. Get away from me, kid. You bother me.
Gryffindor.
Buenos noches, mein Führer.
Welly, welly, well, well. What'd you say? You nicked your testicles?
That'd be a hot dog.
Irishman. I don't know.
Jack Sparrow.
Four-assed monkey.
It killed the cat.
Well, I guess a vampire has to have grain, too.
Oh, my God. Wow.
When did you say you nicked your testicles? What was that?
What the hell?
Boy.
I don't remember that either.
No, I don't, but I'm kind of happy I said it because it's real funny after the fact.
Yeah. You are Evan, the one-liner, Evan.
The whole Mein Führer bit, I love that stuff.
Keep it going. That's what you're saying?
Okay. Yeah. Got a few more categories to get through. Most outrageous illogical statement or pseudoscientific claim of the year.
Oof.
I got one.
Go for it.
I'm going with Aiken.
Yep.
Yeah.
Aiken.
Oh, yeah.
Legitimate rape.
Oh, yeah,
shutting
that's
that whole
terrible.
Thing down.
That was pretty bad.
Not only was it scientifically idiotic, but it got mainstream news going, and it had serious political ramifications, I think.
Yep, he lost.
He had been a lock to win his seat, and he lost it. And a lot of people think that that was why. So, good.
Not to pick on politics, but my pick was something along similar lines. You guys remember who said this? We oppose the teaching of higher order thinking skills, critical thinking skills, and similar programs that are simply a relabeling of outcome-based education, which focus on behavior modification and have the purpose of challenging the students' fixed beliefs and undermining parental authority.
Oh man, I remember that too.
Who was that?
That was the Texas GOP platform.
Oh.
Ah. You made us think it was a who.
Now, they retracted it or they changed it.
They
afterwards.
Tried to wiggle out of it, but they opposed higher order thinking skills and critical thinking because you don't want to challenge students' fixed beliefs or parental authority.
Right?
Why'd you have to remind me of that? Now I'm pissed off all over again. Oh my God.
Why are you alive at that point?
So that was bad.
That's not even one jerk saying that. That's a consensus of opinion of a group of people.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Imagine the outliers in that group. What would they have said?
Well,
if that was the middle of the road for the group, but
yeah.
You're not going far enough. You need a lobotomy.
Well, hello, Westboro Baptist Church guy.
Oh my God! Yes,
anything they say.
So that's your outlier right there.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't think it's unfair to pick on political stuff in this because, you know, it was an election year here in the U.S. First of all, but also anytime, you know, these are the things that have actual influences on our day to day lives and can seriously hurt, you know, science,
absolutely,
and scientific progress and education.
I do have that was the worst statement. I do have a pick for the pseudoscientific claim, and that was the ghost box. You guys remember the ghost box?
Oh, yes.
The pareidolia generator. It bounces around different radio frequencies to produce random snippets of noise from different radio stations,
right,
and you listen until you hear a phrase.
Wow.
And that's a ghost. That's how you communicate with ghosts.
Right.
It was a pareidolia generator. Totally ridiculous.
Wonderful.
Good points. I had forgotten about that.
That's the point of the show, to remember the crazy stuff from the previous year.
But there was
so many crazy stuff said throughout the year. I don't know how we could pick anything. I mean,
we talked about the two professional mediums who failed their test to demonstrate their psychic powers under laboratory conditions. A test performed by the Merseyside Skeptics not long ago. And, you know, Simon Singh was also part of that testing process. And one of the psychics had this to say: skeptics need to realize you cannot see, hear, feel everything as solid matter with the human eye, ear, and body. Psychics and mediums use a whole other part of the brain which is underdeveloped in the average man.
Yeah, it's standard new age BS.
And what might that be? Go, keep going. You know, like, okay, you stick your foot in your mouth. Now, like, put it in even further.
Wiggle your toes now. About? Yeah,
right.
Psychics, an underdeveloped part of the brain. You know, what more can these people say when it comes to this stuff? That stood out to me, so I put that on my list.
Evan, in a way, it kind of sounds like she's saying that, and therefore you're a lesser being.
Yes, I think you're right, Jay. I think that is their interpretation, or at least some people's interpretation of that, is that we are not whole, whereas they are.
The Italian court system. I noticed somebody nominated me as Jackass of the Year in a thread somewhere.
Yeah, they make that list,
sure. I agree.
So let's move on to Jackass of the Year. Oh, wait, Rebecca already did. Yeah, Jackass of the Year. You're reading ahead, Rebecca.
She can.
So I agree.
Oh, wait, I thought that's what we were talking about.
No, we're talking about the worst claim or statement, but Jackass of the Year is next. Yeah, so I agree. Right. So they are on the short list and they got a lot of votes. The Italian judicial system ruled against these scientists for not predicting the earthquake or for misrepresenting the probability that there would be a major earthquake. They collectively, whoever was involved with that definitely are on the short list for Jackass of the Year. Not my vote, but I agree they're on the short list. Anybody have any other votes? Evan, you said you had someone?
Yeah, we can't forget our dear friend who paid us a visit earlier this year. And Rebecca, you gave at least one report about her. Our friend Lady Apostle Helen Ukpabio.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
She's awful.
The witch hunter. Yeah,
the witch hunter. She is dangerous, dangerous. And she had come to America, to Houston, back in January, early in 2012. And this woman is just outrageous. Can't stand her. She got my Jackass of the Year.
My pick, which is the correct answer, by the way, is Stanislaw Brzezinski.
Ooh, cancer.
Pretty awful.
Yeah, this guy's been selling his anti-neoplastin therapy for decades. I mean, bilking cancer patients. And the two things that he did this year, I mean, he could win any year, but the two reasons why I would put him as number one on my list this year. One is he sent his goons to intimidate skeptical bloggers who were criticizing him. You guys remember that?
Yeah.
And two, he slithered away from the Texas Board of Health and who was investigating him this year, and he managed to slip away yet again, so he's now free to practice his quackery and exploit more, you know, desperate cancer patients. Just terrible. So he's definitely my number one pick for Jackass of the Year this year. But let's move to a positive note. What about Skeptic of the Year?
Well, I have a personal one, and that's definitely going to be Mike Lassell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's the only one I put on my list.
Yeah, and he got some votes from our listeners too. I mean, one listener said very eloquently that
he did.
Yeah, that Mike was an inspiration to a lot of skeptics who maybe would not be able to like host their own podcast, but who would want to just work behind the scenes and not be out for fame or credit or anything, but is happy to just do a lot of work promoting science and skepticism. So Mike was a real role model, I think, for a lot of people in the skeptical movement. And, it's great that they realize, you know, the kind of guy that he was and, you know, how dedicated he was, even though it was all behind the scenes.
Yeah. The work that Mike did, that he did for us was such a tremendous time saver. And one of the biggest things was that we didn't have to check Mike's work. You know, it was 100% good all the time. It was trusted and he was consistent. And on top of that, we just loved him so much. I mean,
yeah,
loved doing, you know, we mentioned on the show that we had a very strong friendship with Mike. I mean, he was definitely one of us. But yeah, I mean, there's just so much I could say, but I just wanted, I absolutely, for me, he is the number one skeptic of this year. And, you know, I love him. I miss him.
So I agree, and he's obviously a very personal choice for us, but I will mention a few names that were brought up by, our listeners. Sonal Edamaruku.
Yeah.
Got
he
a
made
lot
my
of,
short list too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So this is the Indian skeptic. He was made famous by the tantric killing, challenge. Yeah, where he, you know, bravely, went on stage and on TV and allowed the tantric guy to try to kill him with his mojo, and of course he survived.
And don't forget, Steve, that was, I think, if I remember, that was arguably one of the biggest skeptical showdowns in history. If you,
oh, yeah.
It was in terms of sheer numbers.
Yeah, watched
millions,
by a lot of people.
Some numbers, what am I thinking? Like 100 million? It's like a crazy, crazy number of people for hours and hours watching this.
And
incredible.
This year, for investigating a weeping statue and realizing that it was a leaky pipe.
Yeah, faulty pipe.
Yeah.
It was sewage water.
Sewage water. That he, for just pointing that out, there's a leak over here, that he was charged with blasphemy.
Yeah.
And he's on the run.
He's forced into exile. He's in Finland.
Crazy.
Oh my God.
If he goes back to India, they're going to arrest him.
Can you imagine fleeing your country, fleeing the law for just pointing out that a weeping statue was a leaky pipe?
Yeah, that's a true commitment to stupidity right there.
I just want to leave the planet. I just don't even want to be here anymore.
With stories like that, you do.
If it comes to that.
But this is where we are needed, Bob, right?
Yeah.
That's why the mothership left us behind. Yeah, so Sonal, I mean, just for bravery and fortitude and, you know, for what he was put through, tirelessly promoting skepticism in a part of the world where it's actually dangerous to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, we're comfortably sitting in our, you know, dens and living rooms doing this. You know, he's fleeing from the law in order to do it. I mean, so he definitely has to be recognized for that.
Yeah.
Also a couple other mentions, Eugenie Scott for expanding the work of the National Center for Science Education to include global warming in addition to evolution. A lot of people like that initiative. And Eugenie's she's a great skeptic every year, but, you know, again, got mentioned this year for that. And Richard Wiseman got mentioned as well. He had a good year, you know, putting out books and
hosting
doing what
conferences.
He does.
Yep.
Yeah, hosting conferences. So he's remains a tireless promoter of skepticism and professional and author. Richard, I really admire him. He gets it done. You know, he really knows what he's doing. He's very thoughtful, very successful, willing to experiment, and, you know, experiments very successfully in using new media and new ways to promote science and skepticism. So I think,
look at the hits on his YouTube videos. They're insane. It's incredible.
Gets millions. Yep.
No, I think he's really one of the good guys.
So, you guys, we should also mention the Australian skeptics for having the AVN have to change their name and not be spreading misinformation about vaccines. I mean, that was one hell of an effort that they put in.
That's huge, yep.
Yeah, culminating in the AVN, perhaps being forced to change their name. So, yeah, the Australian skeptics have been kicking ass for many years, but they had another good year. And they're very tireless down there.
The thing that I really appreciate is that their government responds.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
yeah.
Nice.
Tim Farley did some really excellent work this year in regards to his reporting and keeping us all up to date on what was happening with Mabus, also known as Dennis Marcuse.
Yeah.
Who was arrested multiple times in Montreal. They finally were able to sort of piece together all the parts, and with great help of the skeptical community and great work by Tim, the police were able to track this guy down. And Marcuse has been inundating all of us, you know, Rebecca, Steve, all of us. We received the emails for years now. It's been, oh, I don't know, as long as we've been doing the show, I think. And, you know, finally it got to a point where something really had to be done about it, and they did arrest him once, but twice. And Tim deserves a lot of credit for that work.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, Tim does a lot of stuff like that. You know, he's definitely not a one-trick pony. He's got a lot of things going on. He's one hell of a skeptic.
He is. I also think he's one of the underrated skeptics, you know, who does a lot of work, does a lot of good work, and maybe he's not in a position that gets him a lot of attention, but he deserves more attention than he gets, in my opinion. Okay, well, we're going to move on. Very quickly, we're going to do our in memoriam for 2012 to list the names of those people in the realm of science and skepticism that died this past year. We already talked, of course, about Mike Lassell, who died a couple of months ago. We talked about him at the time, and you know, he was a close friend of ours, a great skeptic, the sixth real rogue, really. And we still miss him. I still think about him every day. Really is was sad that he died so young. We also lost this year Paul Kurtz.
Yeah.
Philosopher, one of the founding members of the modern skeptical movement. Three astronauts died this year. Neil Armstrong, Sally Ride, the first American woman, I should say, into space, and Alan Poindexter, who was a shuttle astronaut, went up on a couple of missions, was killed in an accident. Also, Leon Geroff, we talked about at the Time editor, science editor. Was actually very skeptical, wrote a lot of very hard-hitting skeptical editorials and pieces for Time and Discover. So again, I don't think he got the recognition among skeptics that he really deserved. And then a few other ones, Joseph Murray, the Nobel Prize-winning physician who completed the first successful kidney transplant, and a couple of authors, Maurice Sendak, you guys know who?
Yeah.
Where the Wild Things Are?
Wild Things Are,
yes, Wild Things Are.
Ray Bradbury, science fiction
author. Ray Bradbury, sure.
And you guys know who Eugene Pauly is?
Looking at my bookshelf now.
He's not an author. Eugene Pauly invented the wireless TV remote control.
Oh, boy.
Oh, my God.
Nobody uses those.
And maybe we should mention that the Reverend Sun Myung Moon died this year as well. Not a skeptic, but somebody we know about.
Now, isn't he supposed to resurrect at some point? No.
No, I think that,
good with Jesus or something?
In that mythology, that Messiah cult, it's inherited, so his son is now the Messiah. I think
that's how that works.
Yeah.
Very clever.
All right. Well, that's our best of segment for the year. We're going to move through a couple of regular segments, but Evan, you're going to do Who's That Noisy? And then we're going to finish up with the last of the year, science or fiction. So Evan, first get us updated on last week's Who's That Noisy?
All right, Steve. Yeah. So we'll go ahead and we will play for you last week's Who's That Noisy? A familiar little tune to some of you.
Yeah.
And Rebecca, once again, you actually got it right. I was very, very proud of you. You're showing your inner geekdom and a bit of your history geekdom, because you had to go back a little ways. You'll notice that being the theme song for the game Tetris.
Yes.
Right? Popular arcade game from the 1980s and sort of ubiquitous in a sense now that you can play it on just about any game console you can find. And it's a very simple puzzle game in which you make blocks fit together into nice little patterns and make the lines disappear for full lines. This is a duo, one fellow just on the violin, another fellow on accompanying acoustic guitar, and did a really nice rendition of it. You can see it, find it on YouTube. Just look up Tetris Acoustic, and it comes right up. You'll hear it. It's a catchy tune. I've had it in my head for days now.
It's got an earworm.
Yeah, a little bit.
Earworm.
We will announce the winner on next week's show, along with the winner for the Who's That Noisy that we're about to play for you now, the brand new fresh and hot off the presses. Who's that noisy? Here we go. All right, so we know that tune.
And, yes.
But that's not what we want to know, no. No, no, we want to know what kind of instrument created that noisy.
Yeah, it did sound unusual.
All right, well, that was cool, Evan. Thanks.
Enjoy.
Okay, well, let's move on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Are you guys ready for this, science or fiction? We have a theme, as you might imagine. It's the last one of the year. And I switched up the theme a little bit. It's not the same thing I did last year. These are interesting new species that were discovered in 2012.
Oh.
I did this for the 2011 species, but not as the year end. Episode. And there are four items.
Damn it.
Are you guys ready?
Yeah. Rebecca is.
Yeah. Okay, here we go. Item number one. Biologists have discovered a species of small jellyfish that can float briefly above the surface of the water to evade predators. Item number two. Scientists have discovered a cyanobacterium that creates calcified structures inside its cell. Item number three, an entomologist discovered a new species of lacewing fly from a picture posted on Flickr. And item number four, a new species of primate was discovered, cute and cuddly looking, but with two tongues and highly venomous. Evan, go first.
Okay. Small jellyfish that can float briefly above the surface of the water to evade predators. Entirely? How they kind of... Do they totally disconnect with the water, Steve? Can you tell me that? Or, like, do they still keep a little small part of them in the water?
I think that's enough information.
Okay. I've seen jellyfish floating on the surface of the water. I've never really seen them briefly floating above the surface of the water. But I wouldn't be surprised if they could somehow capture a pocket of air or something. They're so light in a sense that maybe if they can contort themselves in a certain way, they can create a pocket of air and actually, for a moment, ride that little bubble of air, and therefore they're floating above. So I'll say that one is science. The next one is the cyanobacterium, right?
Yep.
That creates calcified structures inside its cell. Oh, God, I don't know. No clue on that one. I'm totally in the dark. But the calcified structures inside its cell, maybe. New species of lacewing fly from a picture posted on Flickr. Okay, I don't see why not. Nothing really wrong there, per se. Lots of pictures of lots of different things out there, and I wouldn't be surprised if somebody, a specialist came across it and said, hey, I've never seen this before, went to look it up and realized, whoa, this is brand new. I say that one is probably science. The last one, the primate. Cute and cuddly looking, but with two tongues and highly venomous. Sweet on the outside, but in the inside, look out. Two tongues and highly venomous. Sure. Okay, I'm going to say the cute cuddly one is science as well. So that leaves me with the cyanobacterium. And I really have to go with that one as fiction because I just really don't have a clue about that one, whereas I find the other three somewhat plausible.
All right, Jay?
The one about the small jellyfish that you're saying they can briefly... Now, you're saying that they can float above the surface of the water, meaning that they're actually leaving the water.
Yes, that's what above means. Not on, but above. That's correct.
How are they getting out of the water?
Oh, I gave a scenario where they might. I thought it was plausible.
I don't know. I don't know, man. Right out of the gate, I don't like that one. Second one. Yeah, so why? The second one about the bacterium that's creating calcified structures inside of itself. Why? That sounds crazy. I don't understand why it would do that. And then how does it get them out? Like, what's the purpose of that whole thing? That's very strange. I don't know, but I just don't know. You know, those bacteria are so weird, and there's so many reasons why they've evolved to extremes. So I just don't know, Steve. The third one about the scientist found a new species from a picture? Sure. I completely believe that, and I see no reason why there's so many insects out there that we haven't discovered yet. Yeah, this one about the primate with two tongues, and it's highly venomous. That this one reminds me of Galaxy Quest. You guys remember that movie? The little cute guys, and they whip out with those big, crazy gorilla teeth and all that stuff. That was awesome. Anyway, sure. Okay, yeah, it's weird, but he's got two tongues, and he's highly venomous. Fine. I'm going to say that the first one about the flying jellyfish is a fake.
Okay, Bob.
All right, the jellyfish, at first I was like, no effing way, but it is a small jellyfish, and perhaps it's unusually strong, you know, adept at moving around such that it could actually kind of like jump through the water, jump out of the water, and kind of stay there very briefly. I can kind of imagine that. I can't imagine it, you know, you say briefly, I can't imagine, you know, a half a second or a second above the surface would be terribly helpful in evading predators, but, I mean, getting out of the water at all, it's, I'm sure can be some help, but I can kind of see that one. I got a problem with it. The cyanobacteria creating, calcified structures. Yeah. I mean, I could see that. I mean, they can, isn't that how we discovered them? By those calcified structures that they can build outside the body. Never heard of anything being constructed inside. I'm not sure, like, I agree with Jay. I don't know why they would do that, but if they can create it, then sure, they can, why not somehow create it and then incorporate it? So I can kind of see that too. Let's see, the new species of lacewing from Flickr? Sure. I mean, this was too easy, and I'm afraid this one might actually be it, but, so many bugs, so many flies, and Flickr images are ubiquitous. So sure, I could totally see that. And then this one, the last one I've got a big problem with. I don't know, something about a primate with, two tongues, not just a split tongue, but two tongues and highly venomous. That I've never heard of anything even remotely similar to that in any other primate. That one's really rubbing me the wrong way. I gotta choose between one and two. That can float. Not like leaping and actually hovering for a moment. How, jellies. And it is jelly, by the way, not jellyfish, as you're well aware.
Yes, I
know. I mean, how do they actually get around?
Oh.
Yeah, I'm going to bet that this jellyfish is so small that it's just so light. And maybe the way it's constructed also helps it somehow hover very briefly above the water. I'll go with the primate. It's the two tongues and highly venomous is just not, I'm just not seeing it.
Okay, and Rebecca.
All right. So the primate thing. Bob says he's never heard of anything like that. I don't know about the two tongues thing, but I do know that the slow loris excretes a poison from its elbows and is, I believe, or at least was, the only poisonous / venomous primate around. Wow. But if the slow loris can leak it from its elbows, then I'm sure another primate can be venomous as well. The two tongues thing is weird, but I don't think Steve would make this up. I think it's too out there. It's too much like something out of Futurama or Galaxy Quest, as Jay mentions. The lacewing fly on Flickr. I feel like I may have read about this, but maybe it turns out to have not been a new species. Maybe it was thought to have been a new species, but then when it was investigated, it was an existing species. That's the only way I can think of that might be the fiction, but it might be. Which leaves me with the other two, and I'm torn between the jellyfish and the cyanobacterium with calcified structures. Cause that's bizarre. The little jellyfish though, that's wonderfully bizarre, and I hope that it's true. So because I have no idea one way or the other, I'm going to bet on hope. And go for the bacterium being the fiction.
Yes.
Okay.
Thanks for joining me, Ruby.
Not a bad spread.
No problem.
Guys didn't totally cover every choice. So
as
you got Evan and Rebecca with the cyanobacterium, Bob with the primate, and Jay with the jellyfish, which means you all think that an entomologist discovered a new species of lacewing fly from a picture posted on Flickr. You all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Oh, yeah. That pause, Steve, that pause. You're giving me a heart attack here.
Right?
Yeah, that was kind of an easy one, but it was cool. I had to put it in there. partly why I went to four items this week. So yeah, there was somebody posted this very nice picture, very technically nice picture, close up of this lace wing fly, and posted it up on Flickr. Wildlife photographer Hak Ping Gwek posted the picture of the fly, and then an entomologist, Sean Winterton, spotted the picture and noted that it was an entirely new species. And named it.
Wow.
Yeah, Semichiza jade.
Awesome.
I thought he'd throw Flickr in the name.
Yeah, Flickr eye. Yeah, that would have been cool. But no.
Ah, clever.
Yeah, but yeah, very pretty lace wing fly.
His jaw must have dropped when he saw it. I was like, holy crap, somebody posted an image of Flickr of a new species.
Woo-hoo. Well, that's like, you know, we talked earlier this year about the dinosaur that was discovered sitting in a drawer.
Yeah.
what's that?
30 years ago, you know, so the stuff is out there. Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's go to number four. A new species of primate was discovered. Cute and cuddly looking, but with two tongues and highly venomous. Bob, you think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And this one is science. Sorry, Bob.
Two tongues.
That was the kicker
yeah,
for me.
That's rough.
Two tongues. Like that's a perfect one.
See, that's a problem. We're too alike. You know, when it freaks you out, freaks me out, and then bam, done. You're done, Bob. Adios.
What kind of primate do you think this is?
I don't know.
Old world.
Rebecca got it. It's a slow loris.
Woo!
Wow.
What is it?
Thank you.
How slow is he?
Loris is, well, it's a primate in the suborder Strepsirrhini. So yeah, so slow loris is, it's a small primate. Very cute, big eyes. They are found in Southeast Asia. This particular primate was thought to be one species, and it was discovered this year that it's actually four species. So really, they discovered three new species of slow loris, and they have two tongues. Now, when I first heard that, what do you imagine?
One on top of the other, side by side, forked. What are we talking?
I was picturing side by side.
Yeah.
A forked tongue that went too far.
I imagined side by side too, but it was one on top of the other.
Oh, that's gross.
It has an undertongue.
He's constantly tasting himself.
He's super popular with the ladies though.
The venom comes from glands under its arm or on its arms that it licks. And then its bite becomes venomous.
With which tongue?
Getting back to the pedantic thing again, we got nailed, I think, once on the toxic versus venomous or poisonous versus venomous.
Oh, yeah.
Something that's poisonous is deadly if you eat it. Something that's venomous is poisonous if it bites you or stings you or whatever.
Or spits at you.
So because this is technically venomous, I guess, and I've heard in reading about this, I've seen both toxic and venomous used.
Although Komodo dragons can kill you if they bite you, and they're not technically venomous.
Yeah, they just have bacteria on their teeth.
Yeah, it's bacteria.
But this is a poison that it's. This is a poison that it secretes. I know. This is a poison that it secretes and it injects it into you by biting you. So I guess that makes it venomous. You know. But yeah, they're adorable. They're threatened because people capture them for pets. They would make horrible pets. Don't try to sell a slow loris as a pet, because they are deadly. And, they're also,
Michael Jackson had one.
They're also threatened because, they're used, they're captured so that tourists could take pictures with them and see them, you know, but they're not domesticated. They really don't belong in petting zoos or as pets. And now that there are four species, so it's good and bad in that they're now much more endangered because now it's essentially their numbers are cut. Of each species is a lot less than if they were all one big species. It'll be a lot harder to maintain each of the four species, but that also does make them more endangered. So it may help efforts, you know, to keep them alive. So very cool. Okay. So we're down to the cyanobacterium or the jellyfish. We'll go to number one. Biologists have discovered a species of small jellyfish that can float briefly above the surface of the water to evade predators. Jay, you think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And this one is the fiction.
Wow. Oh,
God damn it, Jay.
Jay, yes. And on a solo victory. Very nice.
It's so sweet, like honey baby.
Nice. It's a honey baby.
Take a bite, Jay.
Not honey boo boo.
That's something else.
So yeah, I made it up, but
Made it up.
I threw the small in there just to make it semi-plausible, but, and I looked to see if I did searched for jellyfish that floated. I tried, you know, multiple search terms. I couldn't find anything. So there may be one out there, but there's nothing discovered this year.
I hope a marine biologist is listening and call.
Yeah, call me on it. Cause it's hard to prove a negative. You know, I look for it. I couldn't find any jelly that floats above the water. I think if that were discovered this year, I would have seen it on all the sites I went to looking at the cool species discovered in 2012. There was a jellyfish discovered this year, or actually it might have been last year. I think it was actually in 2011. That kind of inspired me to do this. This was strikingly beautiful but venomous box jelly. I guess there was a naming contest. There were over 300 entries were submitted, and they went with the name Tomoya Oboya.
Oh, God.
What?
Tomoya Oboya.
And that's terrible. That's...
I know. Oh boy is what people yell when they get stung by the jellyfish. That's how
And then they die.
Oh my gosh.
Tomoya Oboya.
Leave the naming to us instead, please, next time.
Which means that scientists have discovered a cyanobacterium that creates calcified structures inside its cell is science. Sorry, Evan and Rebecca. Yeah, so the news items that caught my eye with this one is that a bacteria with a skeleton, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Or bones inside the skeleton. But the calcified structures are not for structural support. They are used as ballast. At least this is the prevailing hypothesis at this point in time. So they weigh the bacterium down so that it can descend to the soil at the bottom of the lake. And get access to it there. So that's, they use it to adjust its weight so it could sink to the bottom.
Awesome.
But you're sinking.
What are you sinking? Yeah, pretty cool. So good, good job, Jay. Good way to end up the year.
Well done, Jay.
Yes.
I think I used my reason to figure out the truth there.
I think you reasoned your way through it very well. You did.
Yeah,
as opposed to stumbling on it accidentally.
Yep. No, it was a tough one. Everyone sort of was suspicious of it, but I just made it just plausible enough.
You had to throw small in there.
I did. I deliberately threw it in there to give it that little bit of plausibility. Yeah. All right. Well, Jay, what's the final skeptical quote of the year?
I have a cool quote here sent in by Claire Dean from the UK. This is from an author named Lane Banks. And here's the quote. It has become my conviction that things mean pretty much what we want them to mean. We'll pluck significance from the least consequential happenstance if it suits us and happily ignore the most flagrantly obvious symmetry between separate aspects of our lives if it threatens some cherished prejudice or cozily comforting belief. We are blindest to precisely whatever might be most illuminating.
That was far away.
Yeah, I enjoyed that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You actually took a little stroll there, Jay.
Yeah, that took a while, right?
Yeah.
And don't forget to get your tickets for Nexus. The conference this year is in early April. We have awesome speakers. We've been working on the conference diligently, and we are continuing to add new things to it. We're adding a Friday night special activity that's going to be really cool, something unique to Nexus. Go to nexus.org, purchase your tickets. You can buy tickets to also our workshops, which are happening all day on Friday. You can take a look at the different things that are going on. We're actually putting one together that Steve is going to be instructing, which will be really fun.
Yeah, I'm going to do a workshop on how to use podcasting and other social media in order to promote some cause or activism. Yeah. I'll give you all the nitty-gritty insider information on how to technically and creatively create and run a successful podcast.
And Steve, can you pronounce our keynote speaker's last name?
Oh yeah.
Do it.
Mladenov.
Say it again.
It again.
Leonard Mladenov.
Yes, Leonard Mladenov. He's awesome. And he's like, again, one of those guys that hasn't really been making the rounds at skeptical conferences, but will be awesome. He will have a lot of interesting things to say. I'm really looking forward to seeing him at the conference, and hopefully we'll get to interview him for our show while we're there as well.
What does he do?
Theoretical physicist.
Really?
Yeah, and he's also an author. He's written a couple of books with Stephen Hawking.
All right. Well, thank you for joining me this week, and thanks for joining me this year, guys. I think it was another great year.
It sure was.
Have a great year. Let's have another one coming
up. Yeah, we look forward to going again in 2013. We did get renewed for another
2013.
Season.
Oh, hooray.
Thank goodness. Yes.
Twice the salary.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the contract was a real bear, but yeah. We agreed to get paid.
Fringe benefits.
Yeah.
Fringe
do
benefits.
You agree to record 52 episodes for free? Yes, I do. Thank you.
Sign here. You're done.
All right. Well, thanks again, guys. And until next week and next year, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website, or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.